You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics podcast and show, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and today we're going to take a look back at the unprecedented and tumultuous 2020 presidential election as the first wave of books about the race hit the bookstores. The best out there so far is called Battle for the Soul, Inside the Democrats' Campaigns to Defeat Trump, and the author is my guest today. He's Edward Isaac Dover, who is the lead political correspondent for The Atlantic Magazine, and this is a really good book. Not only in taking you inside and providing a lot of details of the campaign, which was aired a couple weeks ago, for example, Bernie Sanders' demands when he travels, but more significantly, it's also really good in looking at some of the analysis on what happened and why. So I urge listeners to grab a copy of this book. And Isaac, thank you so much for taking the time to be on today.
Hey, Robin, it's great to be here. And I'm glad you enjoyed the book. I hope all your listeners enjoyed as much as you did. And I'm really excited to talk to you about it.
It really, the Biden victory, as you lay it out here, the twists and turns, and you describe it at the end as almost a twist of fate, how this could have gone off track so many ways, and it just seemed like it was meant to be in the end. But is that the way you kind of look at it here as far as the big picture and how and why he was able to win?
I think when you look back at what happened there, it can feel almost like a novel, that this was where things were going. But what the book tries to trace is all the ways that things fit together in a particular set of circumstances, down sometimes to the day as things were happening, that led to Biden being able to come from what was a pretty rough start to his campaign and an even worse middle to his campaign, to obviously things working out for him then. But it is not right to say that he just got lucky or that things went his way. You have to see all the pieces that would fit together. And the other part of it is that certainly in terms of the general election, with the pandemic and everything that was set off by the pandemic, and with everything that was set off by the reaction to George Floyd's killing, you see Biden needing a moment that he could never have anticipated would be the moment that the country and the world found itself in by last November. And it's that The book ends with an interview that I did with him as president. It's the first interview that he did as president. He was in the Oval Office reflecting on how he got there. And there is just no question that the presidency that now he has in front of him, as he was thinking about it then and as he continues to go through it, is not at all what he thought it was going to be when he jumped into the race in 2019.
Well, I didn't know, some of the things your book reveals is some of the backroom maneuvers or whatever, but it seems like the prevailing narrative was Clyburn's endorsement was there, and he gave it to Biden, and it changed things, and that was it for the primaries. But there was some other – Clyburn wasn't necessarily locked in the way the public narrative is fed anyway.
Right. That's Jim Clyburn, a super powerful long-time who did change the course of the Biden campaign. But what is important and to look at here is that Clyburn, he was always going to vote for Biden himself. He wanted Biden to be the nominee. But he was not necessarily going to do a big endorsement in the way that he did. He wasn't going to do it in the complete, full-throated way that he ended up doing. And as things are going poorly for Biden, after he comes in fourth in Iowa, fifth in New Hampshire, it looks like the campaign is collapsing, Clyburn is not going to step forward. He's just not going to do it. Then Biden comes in second in Nevada, and the race starts to look like it's between Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden. And Clyburn didn't want Bernie Sanders to be the nominee. Didn't want it because he doesn't agree with Bernie Sanders. in politics, he also was concerned that Bernie Sanders would lose to Donald Trump. And so that the combination of those things, Biden doing well enough in Nevada, even though he's about 20 points behind Sanders coming in second place, convinces Clyburn to endorse Biden. And he uses this very emotional, strong endorsement that has a reverberating effect. And when I talked to Clyburn afterwards, he said to me that he did not anticipate it would have as much effect. That, but it, it, in so many different ways. For example, Al Sharpton was told Bernie Sanders, Bernie Sanders says, I'm ready to endorse you a couple days before the South Carolina primary. And he was going to follow up and get it together. That would have been a major moment for Sanders and probably change, at least in the immediate of it before these happenings were going. And then Sharpton hears that Clyburn is endorsing Biden, and he decides, you know what, I'm not going to cross in Clyburn here. I'll just step outside of it. Also, you have things like Buttigieg, who was at that moment, and he had come in that narrow victory in the Iowa caucuses, come in second in the Hampshire, he was thinking that he might be able to pull off the nomination, and came closer to it than I think most people realize. And he, in South Carolina, thought, you know, I'm going to do him to have a photo op with a bunch of mayors, small town mayors. Wasn't supposed to be an endorsement, just to have a shot of them together. And then after Clyburn's endorsement, those mayors canceled the event because they don't even want to be communicated with a candidate who wasn't a good Clyburn. So it just rippled out in all these ways, and all of it went to Biden's benefit.
And the other key factor, which you bring up in the book that I had forgotten, was that there were no African-American candidates left that could have influenced Clyburn and other leading black figures' thinking at the time.
That's true. And there was thinking early out from the Sanders team in particular that you would have, Sanders had trouble connecting with black voters in 2016. He had tried to make some inroads in the years afterwards, but not really succeeded. But he thought, and his campaign thought, that if there were multiple black candidates in the field by the time of South Carolina, then they would split that vote and he could kind of slip through without needing a lot of black support to at least have a good showing in South Carolina, not to just win outright. But Kamala Harris dropped out in right after Thanksgiving in 2019. He's out of the race. Then Cory Booker is struggling. He dropped out right before the Iowa caucuses. Deval Patrick, who had gotten in late after thinking that he was going to get in earlier, but his wife was diagnosed with cancer, but he jumped in very late in the race in the fall of 2019. And he did so poorly that even his hope was that he would do well enough in New Hampshire, neighboring to his state of Massachusetts, where he was governor, and then do well in South Carolina, but that kind of swing shot him into contention. But he ended up getting 1,200 votes total in the New Hampshire primary, and dropped out the next morning. So he's down by South Carolina, too. So then, amazingly, in South Carolina, which has, as we all know, a pretty sizable black portion of the primary electorate, there are no black candidates in it.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting how you pointed out how COVID played such a key role in Biden's race, and the strategy was almost to make COVID the key issue, which, if so, it played smartly. But it was also it played to Trump's weaknesses, but also covered up some of Biden's weaknesses as well. Can you kind of share what your thoughts were with that passage?
Yeah, I went to a lot of events for a lot of candidates around Iowa. That are many of which I think some of your listeners want to see. Whether it was Buttigieg or it was Warren or Bernie Sanders, you'd see much bigger crowds showing up for them than for Biden. Every time, no matter what. And even bigger crowds would show up for Trump, and Trump had this devoted fan base that obviously he's still looking to tap into with the rallies he's going to do starting this weekend. Those rallies, if there's a normal rally, no pandemic through the year last year, there's almost no question that Trump would have had a much bigger crowd. And one of the reasons why people were skeptical about Biden running for president, and by the way, those people included, among others, Barack Obama, is that Biden never drew those big crowds. Never really was like a big movement rally guy. And so it covered over some of the issues that would have been there as comparing enthusiasm one to the other. It also, the pandemic, made things real to people, the big way, about what government was, what politics was. It wasn't just something that, a fight that was going on that didn't affect anybody's lives the way it often tended to feel, or certainly tended to feel, in years leading up to 2016. But then it was, we were all sitting at home. We were all dealing with what it was to be in isolation from our family and friends, and not knowing when things were going to get better. We were all seeing the effects of the economy, and all of these things that made Biden's argument for just a calm, practical-minded approach to how to make your life different more appealing than it might have been if he had been running in a different environment and saying, look, I've got 50 years of experience doing things in government and politics. The contrast to Trump was really accentuated by the pandemic in a way that benefited Biden for sure.
A major focus of this race, and we saw it coming going back to when Trump won in 2016, was the Obama-Trump voters. And, of course, we're right in the middle of this territory. Iowa had the most Obama-Trump counties in the nation. On the Illinois side of the river, there's 11 Obama-Trump counties, and 9 are right in this region. I thought it was fascinating, your reporting on the focus group of Obama-Trump voters and how they saw this race. And ultimately, that might have played perhaps a deciding factor in states like Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania.
Well, for sure. And there are the sets of focus groups that are done with the Obama-Trump voters toward the end of the 2020 race. And of course, the Obama-Trump voters, they voted for Obama in 2008 and 2012, and they voted for Trump in 2016. There's an effort by political operatives, journalists, to understand what's motivating voters, given that Obama and Trump are such different people. But what you see, as they've been studied, is that there's the people who just want government to do something and to have more of an effect in their lives that feels like it's going to actually make a difference. And they like the idea that Obama was saying we can do better, and then they respond to Obama not being able to get as much done, of saying maybe we need something much more aggressive and violent, essentially, political terms, and that's what Trump was. Those people in the focus groups that were done at the end of 2020 were undecided about Biden, looked at the two of them, and they said, and basically summarizing here, they looked at Trump and they said, look, I don't really like him personally. Again, the people who voted for him in 2015. They said he's better for doing for the economy. That's what he's doing for the economy. It's not really his fault what happened with the pandemic, but and certainly in getting out of the pandemic, they felt like he would be able to improve the economy then. But they didn't think that he could get the country out of the pandemic. They looked at Biden and they said, he's a good man. I don't think he really knows what's going on with the economy and how to fix it and how to make it better. And I'm not really sure about some of the things that's going on in the left flank of the Democratic Party, like defund the police and those kinds of conversations around socialism. But he does seem like he can get us out of the pandemic. And those voters broke more for Biden than for Trump. That's important because it went out in Michigan and other states that you flipped a total combined 77,000 votes in just 4 states, then Donald Trump would have won the electoral college. So though Biden had a 7 million vote win in the popular vote, even if everything had been the same, but just 77,000 people voted differently, voted for Trump instead of Biden, then Trump still would have won the electoral college then, despite winning the popular vote.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is author and reporter Edward Isaac Dover, who's just wrote a book called Battle Soul, Inside the Democrats' Campaigns to Defeat Trump. Talking a little bit about that book, it's an excellent book, and not just for political junkies, but those who are interested in our country and from a historical, political, economic perspective, or just concerned about the future of the country. I think there's some great stuff in here. And Isaac's been sharing some of that here. I want to follow up on the last question. Some of these Obama-Trump voters, you just made the point that leaned towards Biden and provided him an edge, which could have been decisive in some of these key states because of the close nature of the race. However, it seems like, anyway, they went didn't stick with the Democrats down ballot. And, of course, the Democrats' performance down ballot was disappointing, everybody agrees with. What was going on there? Why wasn't there just a consistent vote for these folks for Democrats right on down the ballot?
Well, I think you point out correctly that Democrats went into Election Day last November thinking that they were going to have a really good night, not just with Biden being elected president, but with winning a bunch of Senate seats. And there was even some thought that they would expand their majority in the House. They did not win many of the Senate seats that they thought they were going to win. Like Maine was a good example of a place where Democrats figured that one was done. Susan Collins was going to lose. And the Democrats ended up losing 13 House seats, which, given that Biden won by 7 million votes, is a pretty stunning result. And what you see is that in a lot of places, there was much more resonance for Biden than there was for the Democratic Party. That in almost every House race and Senate race, Joe Biden got more votes in that area than the candidate for House or Senate did. One of the things that speaks to is that people are more engaged in presidential elections. There was certainly an anti-Trump vote that was benefiting Biden. But it's also about Biden's brand, his own personal brand, his own the way his politics were, being more appealing to voters than the Democratic Party was. And that's a real question that now presents itself as we start to think about what the midterm next year will look like, and even 2024. What does politics look like when, at least in the midterm, neither Joe Biden nor Donald Trump is on the ballot? And when the pandemic, hopefully, is not as much of a factor by this time next year as it was this time last year. And then for 2024 as well, Joe Biden says that he's going to run for president again. He took the president at his word. We don't know what Donald Trump's plans are going to be. Again, hopefully the pandemic will be a faded memory by then. But how do Democrats get the enthusiasm that they need to be there for candidates who are not Joe Biden? That's their big problem. How do Republicans get the turnout that they need, that they haven't been able to get, when Donald Trump hasn't been on the ballot? That's how this, these two things are colliding here. But for the Democratic Party, it's a question of personality. It's also a question of ideology, because on some things, very specifically, Joe Biden kept a distance where a lot of the activist energy of the Democratic Party was going.
You mentioned Obama earlier, and your book does a great job of exploring this fascinating relationship between Obama and Biden, and how it almost comes across that there was almost a condescension among Obama, but maybe more so with his aides. And you mentioned that they saw perhaps Biden being vice president as the capstone of his career. And there was skepticism about him as a candidate up until he kind of finally got things going a little bit. But I thought that was interesting, and you made a comment that Obama inadvertently helped usher in what followed. I thought that was interesting. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Obama's legacy is very full and complicated, but I think politically you have to look at some of the numbers that tell a story here, which is that there were over 900 seats in state legislatures around the country which were held by Democrats at the beginning of Obama's presidency, that by the time he left the White House, were held by Republicans. That the House and Senate were both Democratic when he came in. They were Republican when they left. The majority of governors were Democratic when he came in. The majority of governors were Republican by the time he left. So there is a nurturing of Democratic Party that was not done by Barack Obama, whether that was investment in Democratic infrastructure, or figuring out how to make his popularity and his brand of politics translate to other politicians in the Democratic Party. As for Biden himself, there was always a sense from the minute that he was his career was basically done. Remember, by the time that he is selected as the running mate to be the vice presidential nominee, he's 66 years old, right? It didn't seem like he would be running for president again. And there was that basic understanding. And then over the time that Obama and Biden get to know each other, there's a moment that I report in the book of Biden flying around on Air Force Two as vice president at one point, where he reflects and he says, I've never seen someone who's better at talking to 10,000 people than to one. That's how he looks at Obama, whom he has an amazing respect for, admires him in a lot of ways. But he's just confused that Obama's so great at electrifying a huge crowd, but doesn't have that tactile retail politics touch that Biden does. Now, one of the people that I interviewed for the book is Jen Psaki, who had been the communications director for Obama at the end of his presidency, spent a lot of time working for him. Now, of course, is the press secretary for Biden. When we spoke, she didn't know that she was going to be the press secretary. But she said to me about Obama that he underestimated Biden's political abilities because there's so much the reverse of his own. And so when Obama is looking at Biden and wondering, can he pull this off, he's seeing what worked for him. Now, as we were saying, the campaign probably would have been different if not for the pandemic, and maybe Obama's assessment would have held up more. But because the conditions of the campaign were so different, it ended up playing to Biden's strength in ways that were really important for Biden.
It seems sometimes like Biden undersells himself. I mean, you had a quote in there where Biden told you that he sees himself as a bridge, nothing else. I was thinking a bridge to what or a bridge to where?
Well, I mean, that speaks to the different sense of the presidency that he has now than he did during the campaign. When he said that line, it was March 9th, 2020. I remember it well because it was the final rally of the Biden campaign in any proper way. We were in Detroit in a high school. There was, when we were walking into the event, there were people on either side of the door with these big jugs of hand sanitizer, just saying, hand sanitizer, hand sanitizer. Everyone's like, oh, why do we need to do this? But it was when COVID was something that we had heard about, but not really processed what was going to happen. Notably, that's the event where he's endorsed by Cory Booker and Gretchen Whitmer, the governor of Michigan, and by Kamala Harris. All three of them endorsing it. Whitmer and Harris end up being the finalists for who he's going to pick as his running mate. Obviously, he picked Harris. So that's what's happening there. And he looks at these people who are younger than he is, who are the next generation of Democratic politics. And what he's saying then, at the end of the nomination process, after Super Tuesday, it looks like he's pretty sure going to be the nominee, is he's saying, look, I know this seems kind of strange to everybody. The older white guy from a different brand of politics, how is he the leader of the Democratic Party in the year 2020? But he says, trust me, I can bring us to where we need to be as the Democratic Party. He's making an argument that puts himself in history in a way that is not so much about Joe Biden being the president, but is Joe Biden bringing all this along. Now, then the pandemic hit and all of the things that we've seen over the last year. And by the time that I spoke with him for that interview at the beginning of February that's in the book, he points out to me the picture of Franklin Roosevelt that he's put over the fireplace in the Oval Office. That's a fine spot. He talks to me about how he says, I'm the most progressive person who's ever been president, which is a brushback to Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, but also to Barack Obama, to anybody who says, like, oh, you're just Joe Biden. He has this vision now of his presidency as being extremely important in history because of the opportunity that's there, because of the need that's there created by the pandemic. And he looks at what's in front of him here, and he knows that his presidency is a function in part of Barack Obama, right? That Obama, he was picked as vice president, elevated to that spot because of Obama, given the connection with black voters that was so important to him because of Obama. He knows, of course, that his presidency is in part a function of Donald Trump, and that he's the reaction to Trump. He was the one that people thought could beat Trump within the Democratic process, Democratic primary process, and that benefited him. But now he looks at it and he says, that's not going to be the only way that I am in history. I'm going to have a big legacy of my own. And I think
anybody who's elected president probably as soon as they finish the oath of office starts thinking about what their legacy is going to be. Biden is the oldest president ever. It's very much in his mind all the time. He's not going to be around probably. I mean, hopefully he'll live and do well a long time, but he's, realistically, in 50 years, he's not going to be around to look at what his presidency brought. He wants to see these results right away for his own sake and his own ego, but more importantly, for knowing what the country is facing and how dire the situation is in so many different ways.
This is unfair, but I've only got like a minute or two left, and I'd like you to answer this, but... But I'm reading through the book, the next to last chapter, you veer off into talking about the Kennedy-Markley Senate primary up in Massachusetts. I'm like, well, what's this got to – but then you wove that in very nicely, I think, to the rest of the book. Tell us, if you can, briefly, it was a test of the theory of power. What was that?
Yeah, well, look, it's a Massachusetts Senate primary, Democratic primary. It's like the purest Democratic primary contest that there could be. And it's Joe Kennedy, RFK's grandson, versus Ed Markey, a longtime politician in Massachusetts. And they're both fighting over who is the progressive in the race. And what you see is that even though Joe Kennedy had identified with a lot of positions that were very much in his favor as a progressive, that because Markey had put himself in alliance with people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the Sunrise Movement, the Green New Deal energy that's in among progressives in Washington, that led to this idea that Markey, who has a voting record that is pretty similar to Joe Biden, was this great progressive hope. And by the way, Markey is in his 70s as well. And Joe Kennedy is 40 years old. And it's everything that you would think would be in Joe Kennedy's favor, if you were looking at the race from a distance, ended up being in Ed Markey's favor. And Kennedy, by not being associated with the sort of most identified capital P progressives at this point, he never really had a chance by the time the race got going. And it led to the defeat of a Kennedy in Massachusetts, which until last year had never, ever happened.
Well, I wish we had more time, but we're out. Isaac, I appreciate your brief answer there. There's a lot more questions I had. Kamala Harris, I wanted to ask about that. And I wanted to ask about your car problems in Northeast Iowa that was in the acknowledgement section. But our listeners are going to have to go get the book and read about all that. I want to, again, encourage folks to get a copy of this book. It's an excellent reading of this unbelievable election. That took place, probably the most significant in our lifetimes. It's called Battle for the Soul, Inside the Democrats' Campaigns to Defeat Trump. And the author was kind enough to be my guest today, Edward Isaac Devere. Isaac, thank you again so much for being my guest.
Hey, Robin, thank you so much for that. And hope everybody enjoys Battle for the Soul, because there's a lot in there, like you said, that we didn't get to. There's a lot of ground to cover in trying to figure out how we got to where we are and what that sets us up for where we're going.